Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week, we're talking about Louis Theroux's new documentary about polyamory and the Netflix film Outlaw King.
Caroline has also been reading the GQ profile of Ezra Miller, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. God, have we got some delights for you coming up on the show this week?
Yes. This has been a particularly rich week, I feel, in men doing weird stuff. I'm going to thematically link all the things as that.
It's just a fun week for once, isn't it? Like, actually fun. Three fun things to talk about, nothing that's trying to take itself too seriously, which is great.
Exactly, yeah. So the first of those three things is Love Without Limits, which is the first part of the new Louis Theroux documentary series Altered States. In it, he explores polyamorous relationships and communities in Portland, Oregon. He follows several different couples and groups in an effort to understand how their non-monogamous relationships function.
Yeah, so I feel like Louis Theroux's done lots of programs in a similar vein that are about like unconventional relationships. Mm. And that's what this episode is about. And yeah, so he follows three or four different polyamorous relationships, mm-hmm. Depending on how you look at it, in this show. And he starts off by meeting these married couples, Jerry and Heidi and Joe and Gretchen. So Jerry and Heidi are married, Joe and Gretchen are married. And Joe and Heidi are also in a serious long-term relationship. And the way he kind of goes about talking to these people about their relationships. First of all, we meet Heidi and Jerry and get a sense of their marriage. Then we see Joe and Heidi together. And then we get a sense of Gretchen's role in it all. So we kind of see it piece by piece. And the first thing we see is Heidi and Jerry. And I don't know, I think the narrative of the show tries to make it quite clear that they're suspicious of whether Jerry is fully on board with his wife having a second serious relationship alongside their marriage. And it's also Heidi makes it very clear that they're of equal importance to her in her life. And she's also engaged to Joe.
Which I just don't understand how that aspect of it works. And they don't really explore that fully, because obviously it would not be legal for her to like have a second full state licensed marriage with Joe, but maybe the engagement is just a way of signifying that that's what they'd do if it was allowed or something.
Yeah, and maybe it's a thing of like, we hope that one day it will be allowed and therefore we are waiting.
You're right, the immediate kind of, Louis Theroux's documentaries always have a kind of through line or a narrative, which is part of the reason why they're generally really good, because it's not just a case of showing you stuff scene by scene. There is a theme. And in this case, I think the theme is this idea of compersion, which is a word I did not know before I had watched this, which apparently means the state of being really happy for someone else without any regard to your own happiness. So a kind of selfless, empathetic, you know, if it makes you happy, then I'm happy kind of thing. And so they, in this polyamorous setting, they apply that very specifically to the idea that if your wife or partner suddenly says, actually, I want to have another serious relationship with this person because I'm in love with them, you as their initial partner are just like, I'm happy that you're happy, as opposed to, but what about me?
So totally.
That's the idea that they explore over and over again. And in that first scenario, it very much comes out, well, Louis, I think, comes out on the side of, well, this is clearly working really well for Heidi, but is it working for Jerry? Because he doesn't have any other relationships. It's not like he's also seeing other people. He's just seeing Heidi. But Heidi is also seeing Joe.
Yeah. And he kind of, in this very heartbreaking tone, keeps insisting like, well, when I meet, and it is a when, not an if, when I meet my person, you're like, oh God, what if he's maybe just not going to? And well, I don't know.
Also, there are a couple of times when I had a follow-up question that I wanted Louis to ask that he then didn't ask. And my follow-up question in that instance is like, well, are you dating? Like, are you trying to meet other people, Jerry? Are you on apps? Are you going to stuff where you might meet people? Or is this like, your processing, coping way of feeling quite lonely is to just be like, well, I'm going to meet other people, so it's fine that she's met other people, but you're not actually actively doing anything about that.
Yeah. And there's this kind of tone that I feel like a lot of the people in this documentary share, especially the people who are kind of in a more like observant role in the relationship of watching their partner, you know, the people who are experiencing all the compersion for their partners but aren't necessarily in polyamorous relationships themselves, they have this shared tone that's very like, you know, Louis will ask a question that's like, well, doesn't that make you jealous? Or, you know, it's kind of a maybe slightly combative question, and they'll all be like, no, like they're in this kind of tone of like, what, I've never thought about that before, and no, I'm kind of on a higher plane. Like, no, I don't really understand. And it's this kind of sunny tone that I, in Out of Prejudice, associate really strongly with defensiveness and denial and an unwillingness to like explore those dark feelings. And so for me, Jerry is very much suffering from that denial, and that's definitely what it seems. And obviously the documentary is trying to encourage you to feel that way, so maybe I'm just gullible, but the fact that every partner in this documentary, whether it's Gretchen or Jerry or there's like a group of very kind of like hip attractive young people all living in a like commune together, and one of these guys is having a baby with his, I want to say, girlfriend, sweetie, love, as she would call it. And they're having a baby, but she is dating seriously with other people. And he's also shares that tone of like, what? No? Oh, no, it's compersion. I'm fine. Mm. And that I find really like, okay, there's got to be a reason why you're all doing this thing that I associate so heavily with defensiveness.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It does... They have the like slightly blank faces of people who are like theoretically very signed up to the concepts that they're espousing, but they're having to like repress some instinctive emotional reactions in order to be able to say those things. But as you say, I'm aware that that could be my own like ignorance and prejudice speaking, and maybe they are just totally fine. Because I definitely, like the little I knew about sort of poly relationships before I watched this show, what my main like takeaway from talking to people about it who had done it was that it's a lot of communication. Like that's the fundamental thing that underlies it, is that it can totally work in like my friend's experiences, but you have to be like super talkative and you have to be very organized. Like I've had one friend who's like, we have calendars. We have like Google calendars for this.
Yeah.
Because if for a second someone feels like their amount of time with a shared partner is like slipping, or they're not seeing them as much, or they're not getting their best time or whatever, and resentment breeds and they don't then talk about it, then the whole thing can just collapse.
Completely. And it seems to me like it would just be so complicated. All relationships are complicated. Like that's not something that I'm saying in dismissal of polyamorous relationships, but relationships are so complicated in terms of things like, yeah, the figuring out how to spend time with your partner and making sure your partner feels valued and, you know, listening and communication. Like those for me are all the really hard parts of relationships, and those are the parts that kind of get doubled in polyamorous relationships. And polyamory is not about like sleeping around. That's not what it's about. It's not like an open relationship where it's like about encouraging spontaneity and like, you know, just going with the flow and like, yeah, maybe you meet like three people that week and it's great. It's about having like more than one very serious partner.
Yeah, exactly. And the seriousness of that is underlined in the groups that this documentary focuses on by the fact that, as you say, like one person is quite heavily pregnant at the point at which Louis's filming her. The couples we mentioned at the beginning, Heidi and Jerry and Joe and Gretchen, they both have children. Like there are children from the marriages. And again, that kind of raised questions in my head that whilst Heidi and Joe are off having their like loved up time together, Gretchen and Jerry are like individually caring for the children of
taking
those,
on more childcare.
Those marriages, yeah. So I was, one question I had was like, you know, how does childcare fit into this? And that didn't really necessarily get explored, but I'm interested in that. I remember a while ago reading the British politician Shirley Williams's autobiography, and this wasn't a poly relationship by any means, but she was like, because when I was first married very young, we were so poor, we actually lived in a house with, I think, two other couples who were a similar age to us. And we all sort of had children at roughly the same time. And actually, I would highly recommend this arrangement to anyone in that situation, because it meant that there were like six people to do childcare instead of two, and all the children could be like taken to school by one person, thereby freeing up others to go to work and do what they wanted, which isn't the same as this at all. But it just kind of rung a bell with me. It's like, okay, so like group child rearing is totally a thing and can work really well. But actually what you've got here felt like the opposite, like people being isolated.
Yeah, because there are two family homes and it's just like people being kind of split between them. And yeah, there was a moment where Joe, I think, said like in his mind, he'd like it to be everyone under one roof. And every other person in that relationship dynamic was like, that would not work.
That would not be good. Yeah, though the separation was important because, and Louis did try and explore that with Jerry, as like, how would you feel if you walked in on them? And Jerry
and
was
clearly not good.
Clearly not good. And then the other thing that made me feel slightly negative about that relationship was that at the end, when he was doing his kind of wrap-up chat with them, Jerry repeatedly said that, like, you know, if Heidi and Joe wanted to invite me into their physical relationship, I would be very open to that. And Heidi was just immediately like, no, absolutely not, never happening. Yeah. And I was like, hang on a second.
How is this happening for the first time on camera?
But also, like, what about compassion for what he wants?
Yeah.
You know, he's clearly interested in exploring that, and you're just immediately being like, no, never, I'm not sharing. When he has done the opposite for you, you're not even saying like, well, I'm happy to try that and see how it goes. Like, she was just like, no. I was like, no, this doesn't seem to be a two-way street with you. And that's not a reflection on like polyamory as a concept. It's just like their specific scenario felt a bit off.
And that's why it's so hard with documentaries like this, isn't it? Because like relationships are so fundamentally individual and personal, and you're not actually going to go away and find like a good or perfect example of like a polyamorous relationship. You're just going to find all these like weird flawed relationships that are probably going to spark very strong reactions in people, because like when you see other people's like for a start, you don't really see other people's relationships up close very often. And when you do, I feel a lot of the time you can just be like, oh, weird, their intimacy. Like, no, not, I don't want
to. No, exactly.
Like, so it can be quite like, I don't know, it's quite hard to make a documentary about polyamory that isn't going to like make people think like, ew, weird in some way, because that's just what it's like when you put relationships under a microscope. They often seem really dysfunctional and terrible.
I don't think you can form any conclusions about poly as like a good or bad thing from this documentary, and that's not the point, right? It's just supposed to be exploring these specific scenarios. But also another thing that doesn't tend towards that conclusion at all is the fact that there's this interlude where one of the people from one of the groups that he's talking to takes Louis to a kind of like sensual eating party where everybody takes their tops off and like feeds each other strawberries and sort of does a lot of, you know, touching.
It's actually grim. It's like completely grim. I could barely watch it. Like,
same.
Again, it's the kind of thing where maybe in the moment, if I was blindfolded and someone was feeding me something yummy and touching me, like maybe I'd enjoy it, who knows? But like watching other people do that is just so
cringe.
It looks gross.
Especially Louis, who is made deeply uncomfortable by the whole thing. And when later afterwards, I think when someone asked him like, how did it go? He was like, it was just a lot of cheese. People kept giving me cheese.
Giving and didn't cheese. Want he put cheese. Too much cheese on his plate. And then the woman was like, well, maybe that was your opportunity to voice no more cheese. And he was like, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you want to see Louis Theroux with his top off grinding around eating cheese. Weird strawberries, I guess it's what, 45 minutes in.
Mm-hmm. So that I found kind of, yeah, cringe and also a bit irrelevant, because whilst it's like that kind of activity is like specifically the taste of one of the people that he's come into contact with through making this show, it's not an intrinsic part of polyamory at all, or necessarily like a mainstream part of it. So it felt a little bit like this is just there for the viewing pleasure of watching Louis feel uncomfortable rather than
100%. Like there's always got to be that bit in these documentaries where it's like, and now awkward Louis gets sexy.
Yeah.
And like they always do that whenever there's like some sort of sex element to the doc. So yeah, I kind of respect it. It's kind of cynical, but I respect it.
Yeah, and I think it makes for good TV in a way. But yeah, it doesn't contribute to your understanding of the issue at all. But still, interesting film. I learned things, yeah, I think.
Definitely.
For a couple of decades between the First and Second World Wars, something mysterious happened. There were murders in country houses, on golf courses, in far-flung parts of the globe and quaint English villages. No fictional character was safe. Because these events were all fictional, the plots of novels that flooded the market in the 1920s and 30s. People couldn't get enough of all of the inventive ways that writers like Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, and more could think of for people to die. This period came to be known as the Golden Age of detective fiction, and for good reason. So that's what I'm going to be doing in this podcast, telling the stories that lurk in the shadows of the famous detective novels. If you've ever stayed up late reading under the covers to find out who done it, then this podcast is for you. Find us at shedoneitshow.com, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as shedoneitshow, and in all major podcast apps.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is Outlaw King, a historical action film about the 14th century Battle of Bannockburn between Scotland and England. It stars Chris Pine from Wonder Woman as Robert the Bruce, and Florence Pugh, who we talked about last week in The Little Drummer Girl, as his wife Elizabeth. It was co-written and directed by the Scottish director David Mackenzie and released straight to Netflix. So you can stream it in the comfort of your own homes nationwide. In fact, probably worldwide. Yeah, so handsome Wonder Woman's Chris Pine playing leader of Scottish fight for independence. And it is, to me, trying very hard to position itself in the Game of Thrones sort of landscape. It's within the first hour we get like full frontal male nudity, kind of these like dueling scenes where it's like two people who are maybe on the same side, but maybe not, because there's underlying tensions when the sword fighting gets too intense, and like severed limbs attached to crucifixes. And
sort of shock disembowelments in churches and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it's got it all. Also like woman making feminist stand for the weak, hashtag feminist princess. Like, there's a lot of those vibes in there as well. And one of the main roles is the future Edward II, who at the beginning of the film is the current Prince of Wales, played by one of our favourite rising actors, Billy Howell. We've talked about loads of Billy Howell things over the history of Seriously. I feel like we could be like his IMDb hype people. But he kind of, in that sort of Game of Thronesy evil villain, what was he called? The bastard in Game of Thrones. I can't even remember.
Oh, I can't remember, but something.
Who is horrible to his wife Sansa. Yeah, in that kind of role of like literally within the first 5 minutes, he shouts at the top of his lungs, "You snivelling fool! Shut up, you snivelling fool!" And he's got this horrendous bowl cut haircut.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's just got the haircut of a really unpleasant person.
So handsome, Billy Howell, as well. And they've just given him this like awful haircut.
So ugly.
He looks completely terrible.
But it is the haircut of, in a, like a historical sword drama, it's the haircut of the worst person.
It's the haircut of cowardice.
Yeah, he might as well be wearing a sign on his chest that says, like, "I'm the cowardly asshole," because that's what the hair is saying. Yeah, so...
the bowl cut of shame.
As you can guess from how we're talking about this, like, this is quite silly, this film.
Yes,
but not,
it's absurd.
Like, self-consciously so, I don't think.
I'm not sure it is.
No, I think it's trying quite hard to be, like, serious... historical epic. It obviously isn't helped at all by the fact that it's basically covering the same historical events as Braveheart. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who's seen like Mel Gibson running up a hill shouting freedom is already primed with that in their mind when they see these same events. Because yeah, Chris Pine is playing Robert the Bruce. Although in Braveheart, Mel Gibson is playing William Wallace, who you don't really meet. Other than like as a severed limb in this film, it's the same characters and it's the same events and it's the same.
Yeah, it does
vibe.
Rest on the knowledge that you know who William Wallace is quite heavily.
It does.
His first mention is like, "Oh no, look what they've done to William Wallace," and his like leg is on this like, I don't know,
on
plinth.
A spike. Yeah, it's weird.
And everyone's like, "No, this is so terrible." And no one's ever like, "Oh no, that's Scottish hero William Wallace's leg." Like, he could be on either side for all. Like, if you don't know anything about the history or haven't seen Braveheart, it's just like, who?
Exactly.
Why
do
we care about this leg? Apparently, there is a cut scene where like William Wallace is like being really friendly with Robert the Bruce, Chris Pine, and so that you like get a sense of the extent of their bond, and they like cut it. So
yes,
for the
film.
It's just like, what?
It's interesting. So the critical response to this film has been quite mixed. It premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, and I think critics were generally a bit meh. Netflix picked it up on the strength of that, but they've cut 17 minutes from it into the version that you can now stream. And that scene is one of the things that went, possibly because they felt it was too long, or, you know, that scene didn't have fighting in it and therefore was deemed boring or something. But it does mean that the sort of linear chronology of the film is a little bit shaken, I think.
It's really weird because Netflix is not a platform that I associate with like economy of length.
No,
of
I don't
show.
Know why they would care.
It's not like tightly cut, most of its shows.
No.
Like, the binging element of its platform and like the lack of scheduling and advertising has allowed it to kind of create these quite bloated programs and films often. So for the sake of 17 minutes, it's not like, oh God, this film was 4 hours. Like,
no.
for the sake of 17 minutes, it seems like quite a bizarre decision to edit it so ruthlessly. I mean, I'm not saying that those 17 minutes would have saved the film or anything, because it's clearly quite a ridiculous film. But it's just strikes me as slightly odd that Netflix of all platforms would be the one to decide to cut it down.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is really weird, especially when, as you say, it does make the film less understandable by people who aren't like well versed in the history of it or have seen the other films about it. That's strange. One thing I quite liked about it, which I thought was good, was that the beginning of it, I don't know how long it is, but it feels long. There's this one unbroken shot where Chris Pine and the other Scottish lords are having to sort of swear fealty to the English king inside a tent. And then the camera like pans with him outside where he's fighting with Nasty Bowl Cut Man, and then back into the tent and out again to watch a huge catapult destroy something. And it's sort of this one long tracking shot in the way that pretentious directors enjoy.
Caroline, I didn't even notice that.
Did you not?
No.
Yeah, it doesn't
cut.
It doesn't cut between the tent and the outside. Yeah,
I would have just told you that those were like three different scenes. So, and it was a rap on the knuckles for me there, but I had no idea.
So they don't make a big deal about it in the way that it does. The camera doesn't ever come in like tightly on anybody's head or shoulders or anything in the way that you do when it's following someone. But yeah, I read a few other reviews that confirmed that yeah, it is just one entire shot. But
that catapult bit was weird.
Yeah.
They have a really massive catapult fire thing, and then the king says like, oh, I just had it took 3 months to build, so we want to use it. And I was like, wait, is that like a meta joke where like we just watched this kind of pointless but obviously very expensive shot where like a flaming cannonball like soars across the sky? Is that like, oh well,
we had
wanted
it
to
so
build
we did
this
it. So. Yeah.
Or is it just like, oh, this is just to let you know that this king is a bit of a nutter? I can't really tell what the point was.
I didn't really understand it either, especially because the rest of the film is not super CGI heavy. They've mostly, in the battle scenes, one of the things that critics have actually been quite positive about is that the battle scenes are quite, quote, realistic, in that they're quite chaotic and muddy and gory and horrible, and just, no, it's just not clear a lot of the time what's happening or who is who, because it's a lot of like men with straggly hair in long robes wielding swords in bogs, which I think generally people feel is a more accurate representation of what warfare was like at that time, rather than the slightly sanitized Game of Thrones charging about version.
Yeah, completely. I also think it's funny because like this is the kind of film where you can tell, as you say, that there's like an obsession with authenticity from a like props perspective and a setting perspective and all that stuff. So it's the kind of thing where, do you remember when Wolf Call came out and they were like, we spent £30,000 on candles and every scene was lit by an original candle from the time. You're like, great, no one can fucking tell because it's just candles. And like, that's how I feel about this. It's like they've put loads of like money into like authenticity, and then they've just thrown a completely unbelievable script on top of it. Like, this is fine though.
Like, yeah, although I have to say, Chris Pine, as like sword wielding action heroes go, is good in this. His Scottish accent is not horrible, although I'm sure real Scottish people will still find it not good. So yeah, why go to all of that trouble and then not cast like an actual Scottish person?
A real Scottish person. Or just like, even just have like a believable dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely.
just like crazy. I enjoyed the bit where like two people flirt over a bowl of porridge.
That was
just kind
very
of like
good.
Unnecessarily. Like, give me some porridge, baby.
Give
me that bowl.
And I also like, enjoyed the thistle-based foreplay between Chris Pine and Florence.
It's a metaphor. Drop this thistle on your tittles.
That was very funny. So yeah, it's very silly, and it doesn't realise that it is, which makes it perhaps all the more enjoyable. One thing, I think it was in Peter Bradshaw's review in The Guardian, but I can't 100% remember, is the way they've shot the landscape and stuff in this is really beautiful. Like, Scotland looks lovely in this film.
But like, yawn.
Yeah, I know. It's not worth watching just for that. And also, that it's kind of disappointing on a small screen. Like, I can imagine if you saw it in a cinema, that kind of cinematography would make a bigger impact. But like, watching it on my laptop, I was like, yep, mountains, skip.
Yeah.
Next bit.
Well, I don't think we've mentioned the silliest bit though, which is when Billy Howe, in his bowl haircut of shame, goes on like a weird angry rampage in his own hall where he's drinking loads of red wine and spilling it all over himself and just screaming endlessly. And he holds up two dead swans by the neck and goes, buy these swans, I will have vengeance. And that was just iconic. And then just like, just rage it, like just goes on a complete drunk rager.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, it did make it seem like he wanted revenge for the swans, like the swan's death.
How dare you kill my swans? They're also like enormous swans, and then there are later more swans and they're not as big, and I'm like, wow, they really killed off their biggest, fattest, most sacrificial swans for that moment.
So I think probably my guess is the reason why this film didn't get a proper cinematic release is because you would want it to get a kind of like British indie interest, so because of it being Scottish and stuff. Like, do you remember that Macbeth film that we reviewed a while ago?
Which one?
the one that was like super pagan-y, possibly he had famous actor in. Was it Tom Hiddleston? I cannot remember.
But well, it was like, there's Lady Macbeth with Florence Pugh in, but I haven't seen that.
Not that one. No, it was a like sword based one. But anyway, that was kind of very much presented as like a British film about a British thing, and therefore did get a cinematic release. Whereas I think no one here would go and see this film unless it was deliberately to take the piss. And like, why? Unless it has some level of authenticity. But
yeah, also the humour really drops off halfway through. Where the first hour I was like, this is brilliant. This is so stupid and funny.
And then
like,
it just tries to be serious. Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I wanted more jokes.
I wanted more jokes. Like
the final climactic defeats has some good bants in it right at the end. But apart from that, it becomes kind of humourless, which is a real shame.
Which is a real shame. Although I did see an article or several articles that were saying that Scotland is bracing for the tourist effect from Outlaw King. Because apparently Outlander and I guess is some of Game of Thrones filmed in Scotland? I can't remember. Scotland,
I think Game of Thrones in Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland, that's sure. It. Yeah, apparently Outlander for Scotland particularly has resulted in lots of Americans turning up wanting to know where bits of it were filmed.
Caroline, they're gonna crawl all over your idyllic,
that's where I go on holiday. Like, how dare they?
How dare they? Don't they know Caroline goes there to be alone?
I know. So not sure about that. I mean, is this film really going to have such a cultural impact that people are going to do that? I don't know. I think it's super forgettable.
Might be over before next weekend.
Yeah, definitely.
So last week, I recommended that Caroline read GQ's profile with Ezra Miller. I think the profile was by a writer called Ali Jones. And she basically goes and interviews Ezra Miller on his farm in Vermont. Mm-hmm. Is it in Vermont?
Yes, Vermont, yeah.
And that's where he lives. And she kind of says early on that Ezra Miller tells her that he lives on a farm in Vermont. And she's like, oh, yeah, like all celebrities who say that they live in, you know, this one holiday home that they go to very occasionally. But no, he actually does seem to genuinely live there. So she goes and spends time with him and he kind of tries to birth a goat and sings songs to his chickens and seems genuinely quite invested in this weird, like, not hippie because he specifically tells you not to use that word about him, but this kind of bohemian lifestyle he has with his band on this farm in the middle of nowhere.
If this profile also contains one of my favourite sentences, full stop, where it goes, the goats are listening to NPR when Miller carefully opens the barn door. It's like a whole world in that sentence.
Yeah, that is amazing, isn't it?
What are the goats listening to? How can you tell that they are actually listening to it? Like, I just want to know everything about it. So yeah, I enjoyed this greatly. Much discussion of goats and goat rearing, which was very interesting. Also, as I think you mentioned when you recommended this to me last week, the photographs that accompany this profile are all of Miller just wearing like lovely dresses and long coats and amazing lipstick and stuff, because he defines as genderqueer and just likes to wear all kinds of clothes.
Yeah, and he looks fantastic. And It's an interesting profile because I actually think that Ezra Miller should be really, really annoying. And he does a lot of like, quote, eccentric things. And I don't just mean that he like wears dresses because like, so do a lot of people.
Give you the quote that encapsulates that.
Yes, please.
Art makes art. We are but puppets for the great art puppeteer.
Yeah, he says a lot of
that
things
is
like that.
Kind of annoying.
And you can like watch a video of him answering questions in a unicorn onesie and he, you know, making weird music happen out of glass bowls with kind of weird tools. So by all rights he should kind of be a bit insufferable, but he's kind of got a charisma and like, I don't know, like he seems genuinely fairly empathetic and to care about other people. Like it doesn't seem like he's saying a lot of what he says just for show, even though he does say, there's like another quote in there where he says something like, we artists are sensitive people and therefore urban environments are very trying for us. And you're like, no, just be quiet. No, don't say that. but he is, there's something I really, really like about him. I think he's really charismatic. I think he's really interesting in terms of like, you know, he's kind of he's on the cusp of this like style of Hollywood or big celebrity that's kind of like redefining masculinity in small ways. Like obviously kind of like feminine looking pretty boys have been like a staple of Hollywood since like, I don't know, James Dean or something. You can probably trace it back to. So I'm not saying he's doing anything completely revolutionary by being like high cheeked boned and slightly androgynous, but I saw a tweet the other day that was like, said something like Ezra Miller, Harry Styles and Timothy Chalamet, when they hear that Dazed is looking for a feminine cover star. And then it had like a clip of this of Super Nanny being like, you're in a crisis and I'm on my way. And it made me really laugh. But I do think there's some kind of like crossover in their Hollywood brands at the moment in terms of like, yeah, being more feminine and more experimental in what they wear and just like being quite sweet and empathetic and not being like hyper masculine in traditional ways. And there was also a big interview in Dazed last week between Harry Styles and Timothy Chalamet, where they talked about like I really wasn't expecting that interview to be particularly good, because though I love both Harry Styles and Timothy Chalamet with all my heart, I don't know if like celebrities interviewing celebrities is like always produces great interviews.
No.
And like also the both of them are really enthusiastic, often about like really banal things like, yeah, I just love my fans. And it's like, okay, yeah, but like we want to hear a bit more than that from you. But there are a couple of really interesting moments in that interview, and one of them is where they talk about whether what kind of responsibility they feel to portray masculinity in new ways. And so it was interesting to me that those two interviews came out kind of in the same week, because I kind of do see a parallel between their careers.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. The part that is still a question mark for me is that whilst I can totally get that it is fun and interesting and nice for these people to do interviews like this and present themselves in that particular way, in the way they dress and the way they do social media and whatever, does it make any difference to how they conduct themselves in their careers?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they go to auditions dressed like this,
mm-hmm.
or do they, you know, put on their kind of I'm a male star outfit uniform,
yeah,
for that, you know? I'm not accusing any of them of being inauthentic or anything like that. I'm just interested to know, like, does it kind of extend to how they choose to act? I mean,
no,
I know,
totally. I think that's a completely fair criticism,
and that's just something I think we'll have to like see how their careers play out from here to see if that's true. Like, do they, are any of them, as soon as Marvel come knocking, gonna just drop everything and like bulk up for a superhero film, for
and
instance?
It's also easier for them as kind of like white I don't want to say cis, in case, like, because obviously Ezra Miller defines as genderqueer, but like they certainly pass as like cis white straight guys. And like there's a lot of speculation about like Harry Styles' sexuality, and I'm sure there is about Ezra Miller's sexuality and so on, but for the most part they can just walk into a space and be like, oh yeah, there's that like handsome straight cis white Hollywood star. So they're able to then go on a cover in like lipstick and a dress and it to be like, oh, provocative, rather than like, this is how this person dresses all the time. And so I think that definitely does make it, as you say, easier for them. But the more that that happens, hopefully the more that it then makes it easier for other people to live their lives and present how they want to.
And I especially think someone like Timothée Chalamet, who is, because of like the year he had last year, essentially, and the films that he was in and all of the award nominations he got, he's the kind of person who's very much in a place where he's being cast in like serious highbrow films.
Totally.
And I'm sure is very much seen as like a future Oscar shoo-in and all of that kind of thing. And yeah, for someone like him to choose to dress the way he does and stuff, that does feel a little bit more risky.
Yeah, because he doesn't dress super femininely, but I guess like with this Dazed cover with the earring, like he's got like a big dangly earring, and yeah, I can certainly imagine him going even further down that road. I hope he does.
I hope he does, yeah. And I hope that it's not just, and as I say, there's no indication that it is. I hope that it's not just a kind of, this plays
brief
well
trend
on Instagram,
yeah,
type thing. I hope this is how we are and how we choose to be all the time, you know.
So what about for next week, Caroline? Have you got a rec for me?
Yeah, so I am going to suggest that you watch the American sitcom Great News, which I actually don't know a super amount about the provenance of it. It was co-produced by Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, who are, you know, the creative team behind stuff like 30 Rock and Kimmy Schmidt. And it was written by Tracy Wigfield, who was a writer for 30 Rock. So it's very much in the like Tina Fey universe, is how I tend to think of it. And it's a sitcom set on a TV news station. It has Nicole Richie in it as one of the like anchors of the show.
Interesting.
And also some like Tina Fey show regulars, people like Rachel Dratch, who's, you know, in lots of that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's, as I say, I don't really know, like, was it made for Netflix or was it made for something else and it's ended up on Netflix? I don't know. But I find it kind of comforting. It's very much my kind of basic humour, the like Tina Fey humour. Mm-hmm. So I've been really enjoying it recently as like a kind of good thing to put on when you're not sure what else you want to watch.
Okay,
so
great.
I'm interested to know how it strikes you.
Well, I'll check it out. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're SeriouslyPod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.